From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, the Marquette Law School poll shifts its focus to the COVID-19 pandemic. We examine how it's impacting the election and how people are reacting. Then, how the stay-at-home order and the looming recession are impacting real estate projects in the area.
Obviously, the longer it goes on, the less business activity you have in general, the more that hurts demand for the types of buildings that are being built.
Then, Milwaukee's homeless are some of the most vulnerable during the coronavirus pandemic, but there are a lot of ways to help.
Providing bag lunches and sandwiches so that we can continue to resource those to our immediate neighborhood is a great way for folks to get engaged.
Plus, how a Milwaukee church is honoring a homeless man 1 year after his death. Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 pandemic is having unprecedented effects on American life, from the economy to elections. So the upcoming Marquette Law School poll will refocus on how coronavirus is impacting daily life, in addition to the more traditional questions about politicians' approval ratings. The poll's release date has not yet been announced, though director and pollster Charles Franklin says it will be sometime before the spring election, planned for April 7th. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with Franklin about the pandemic, politics, and how the poll has been adjusted.
There's only one key issue, and that's coronavirus and how we're dealing with it and what we know about it and what we're thinking about it. Of course, we're also asking presidential and gubernatorial approval and the state of the economy and views of the candidates, but, this was not the focus of the survey that I imagined a month ago, but I think the importance of this epidemic and how we're dealing with it and how people are responding to it pushes the sort of normal political issues to the back of the back burner.
How are people weighing in on the president, or are those things that you're not going to know until the poll's done?
Well, I certainly won't know or hazard much of a guess on the Wisconsin data because I haven't seen any public polling for Wisconsin since the epidemic really exploded a couple of weeks ago. Nationally, we know that the president's approval of his handling of the coronavirus epidemic is a bit higher than his overall job approval. And in some polls, a fair bit higher. We also had a new Gallup national poll out today showing his overall approval at 49%, which is the best ever in a Gallup poll since he took office. And that it also is consistent with other national polls that seems to show at least a bit of an upturn in the president's approval ratings since the daily briefings began. Still leaves the question of what's the trajectory of that. And at the same time, outlook for the economy over the coming year has taken a sharp negative turn as people understandably have become very pessimistic about at least the next year. So how these things play out still very much remains to be seen. And do they change quickly or do they take a long time to work their way through? And of course, we don't know at this stage exactly what the course of the epidemic will be too, and just how successful social distancing will be and what the peak of the epidemic may be and when that may come.
So given that, and of course, President Trump announced that he would like to see the economy and to see people going back to work by Easter, which is contrary to many experts' advice.
I think on that we simply, if you think of how fast the days are passing, or put it the other way, how long ago a week ago seems, it's awfully hard to say where we will be in 2 weeks or more. At the moment, the rise in cases and the rise in deaths is going up pretty rapidly, doubling every 2 to 3 days. If that were to hold over 14 days or until April 12th, we would have very, very high cases and deaths. And I'm not sure folks would be ready to surge into churches on Easter. But let's see, the social distancing that we're doing is unprecedented in my lifetime, and it may have an effect. The trouble is it takes a couple of weeks to see that effect start to show up, because the infection you don't get today doesn't really show up in the statistics until a couple of weeks from now. So we're really way too early to know whether the steps we're taking will ultimately blunt the curve and make it more reasonable to relax social distancing sometime in the not too distant future. Let me hasten to say I'm not an epidemiologist, and I don't even play one on television. So everything I've said is based on what my analysis of the data shows, but I'm not here to provide serious public health advice.
Well, and on the issue of the uncertainty of the pandemic, it's also uncertain as to how people will respond to President Trump's messages.
I think that's true. I mean, there are so many imponderables here. It is fairly normal for the public to respond positively in a crisis when the president takes action, whatever that action may be. And so from the point of view of public opinion, at least since World War II, when we've seen crises, we've almost always seen the president's job approval move up in the immediate aftermath of that crisis. After the Iranian hostage situation developed, Jimmy Carter's approval bumped up. After Marines were killed in Beirut, Lebanon, President Reagan's approval bumped up. So even in situations that are not positive, there's a rally effect for the president, and I think President Trump is certainly experiencing that now. Sometimes those rallies become sort of permanent and last, and sometimes they're short-lived. And again, I say this is moving so fast that we really should be thinking in public opinion terms about how things change over the next 2 or 3 weeks. I think as the scope of the epidemic becomes more clear, as sort of the limits of the epidemic become more clear, we will see an adjustment of public opinion as people understand whether it is rising as rapidly as some of the models are suggesting, or whether the steps we've taken really have helped to slow the growth and maybe spread out the peak of illnesses.
And you said you didn't have necessarily Wisconsin-specific polling, but Wisconsin is a crucial state in the November elections. Do you see how this pandemic is shaping what's happening on the ground in Wisconsin from both parties?
I think we saw before the epidemic hit that both parties were very strongly focused on targeting voters, getting them registered, getting them to the polls, creating and maintaining contacts with those voters. And that was as true of the Republican side and the Trump campaign as it is true of the Democratic side. The close election in 2016 proved to both parties that even a few thousand votes are critical. What the epidemic has done is throw a monkey wrench in the mechanism of both parties' door-knocking campaigns, because door knocks play a big role in those voter contact operations, but they're obviously impossible to do under the current circumstances. So on the bright side, both parties have also been investing in phone calls from volunteers or other party workers that can be done from that individual's living room, from the from that worker's home. And so in that sense, the electronic means of reaching people by phone call, by text, by email, by Facebook, all of those technical means are still very much available to both parties. And, they've shifted rapidly to replace face-to-face campaigning with the sort of modern technology. I think the main drawback there is that the people who are not connected through technology are going to be harder to reach compared to knocking on their door, which had been a big part of the campaigns.
And is there ability to get data on how the campaigns are doing when it comes to digital outreach?
There are not any good public methods of doing that. Understandably, the parties are not anxious to give away their secrets and what they're doing. Various campaigns and other data sources do things to try to track that. But I don't have access to it, and the public in general doesn't have access to it, because it's information that's valuable to the parties in the campaigns and, of course, therefore is sold to them and to others. I think the other thing is that this has had a big impact on campaigns by the candidates. We certainly would have expected to see Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders here in the state a lot over this week and next. And of course, we haven't seen them at all unless it's on television, in an ad or on the news. And so that's the other way in which the epidemic has affected the campaign, is simply it has completely put an end to in-person campaigns and rallies. For the Democrats, obviously, coming up on the primary, but also for the Supreme Court election that's being held in April, all the city elections that are being held in April, and ultimately for President Trump and his rallies as well.
And do you think, out of curiosity, do you think that for state elections, state and local elections, that there has been a tilt to the incumbent, and the fact that they already have the name recognition, they have an advantage in general, but now given this, with these limits on campaigning, it's probably amplified?
It's hard to handicap that. I think there is certainly a reason to think incumbents are advantaged. But whenever we have polled in past years on Supreme Court elections, for example, we've routinely found over 60 or even over 70% of the public fails to recognize the names of the candidates even a week before the election. So this is a case where the most engaged and involved voters are even more likely to be the ones that voted early or are casting absentee ballots or decide to go out and vote on election day. So I'm not sure whether this mutes the advantages that incumbency has, but it almost surely tilts the electorate to an electorate that on balance is more involved, more engaged, and more passionate about voting.
Interesting. And I think, what's your take on Wisconsin maintaining its April 7th primary and general election?
I have no idea if there will be a last minute change from the governor or the legislative leaders. I'm not going to handicap that. We'll just have to see how it plays out. Certainly the extension of the deadline to file for an absentee ballot has made it a little easier for people to vote from home that way, but it has certainly thrown the normal process of running the election up in the air, because this is simply not a normal time to hold an election. On the other hand, there's good reason not to move it. We have municipal offices around the state who are going to be leaving office after the election. If we don't hold the election in April, those offices become vacant, and that's a problem as well. So I think it's a difficult call, and I'm just as glad it's not my responsibility to make the call. But as to whether the governor or the legislature or anyone else will make a move to change the date, it's getting awfully late to make that change.
And so what are the big trends in terms of voting and voters that you think that we should watch out for between now and November?
I think a clear thing right now is to watch how the evolution, how people view the economy between now and November. Right this moment, we're in a very negative view of the economy, where a month ago we were at one of our rosiest moments in views of the economy. So a critical question will be, when do we see the economy and jobs start back up again, whether it's as soon as the president's idea of Easter, or whether it's sometimes in May, or do we go into June or July? Those would make big differences in how bad the impact of this downturn is and how rapidly we start to climb back out of it. Much of that hinges on how the epidemic develops and whether we develop treatments or protections or simply see the spread slow down through social distancing or other things. So I think this is impossible to handicap today, but the thing to watch is, where are we each month between now and November in terms of how people are seeing the economy and how they're seeing the next 6 to 12 months? The second part is President Trump's job approval, which has been more negative than positive throughout his term, but has been getting a bit better over the last year here in Wisconsin and a little bit so nationally, but which is turning up now in the short term. Does it continue to stay up? Does it rise even further? Does it reach some limit and start to come back down? Those things matter a lot. And then finally, in what seems the distant future, who is the Democratic nominee and how do they do, how do they wage their campaign through the late summer and fall, is still another thing that seems far, far away as of today.
And do you have any advice or information about how the party should be waging their campaigns?
I don't have campaign advice. The last campaign I won was for third grade class president. So I'm well aware of my limitations as a campaign strategist. I will say that I think rhetoric only goes so far when you're involved in crises. And we have two crises, both a public health one and an economic one at the moment. And so I think a lot depends on what the epidemic and the death toll turn out to be and how our hospital system holds up under those strains over the next few months. And at the same time, what the economic impact is and how quickly we can move towards an economic recovery, and then how fast that recovery takes place. Those are things that, are not entirely in the control of the government, not at all in the control of the government in some ways. And so we just have to wait and see. But I think those are the things that are more likely to drive the fall compared to simple rhetoric or simple campaign slogans.
All right. Well, Charles Franklin, thank you so much. This was very enlightening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Franklin is the director of the Marquette Law School poll. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. We'll take a short break, then look at how commercial real estate and projects currently under construction are being affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues here on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There are a lot of buildings currently under construction in the heart of Milwaukee. From new hotels, apartments, and office buildings, a lot of different projects are transforming the cityscape. But with the COVID-19 pandemic and a looming recession, there are a lot of questions hanging over these projects. Tom Dakin is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a regular Lake Effect contributor. He joins Joy Powers each month to talk about commercial real estate in the Milwaukee area.
So I feel like every time we talk, there's, you know, another new building that's going up. And in the circumstance we're finding ourselves in right now, that's a little scary. So I'd like to look at kind of the scale here first. What are some of the big projects that are currently under construction here in the Milwaukee area?
Well, one of the largest ones I was literally just at about an hour ago, the BMO Tower at 790 North Water Street in downtown Milwaukee. This is going to be a new 25-story office tower that's going to be anchored by BMO Harris Bank. They're currently next door. They're going to move from their old building into the new building. And then they'll have other tenants as well, including the Michael Best and Friedrich Law Firm. And it's under construction right now. The developer, Mark Ergens, tells me he hopes to have it substantially completed in April, with some of the tenants moving in shortly thereafter.
So are they still going through with construction?
Yes, they are. And what they are doing, this is as of Tuesday, March 24th, is taking steps to engage in social distancing, like we've been told constantly, continually to do. So you don't see workers huddling together. And let me just add, in construction, quite often, a lot of what you do, the tasks you do, you're not like right dead next to another person. You're being 6 feet apart from another worker in a construction site is something that I think is generally achievable. But you see that walking around the building today, I can tell you I saw a lot of hand washing stations, a lot of hand sanitizer stations, a lot of signs reminding people to wash their hands and to remain 6 feet apart from one another. So you have that going on. The building actually, construction site was actually closed the previous day so they could do an entire, what they call hospital grade wipe down, again, sanitizing surfaces that get touched a lot primarily. So things like handrails, elevator touch pads, door handles, those kinds of things. And yeah, they are continuing to work. Now, one of the issues has been with the stay-at-home order being issued again today by Governor Tony Evers. How does that affect construction sites? I'm looking at the order right now, and I'll have to ask some questions about this, but it seems to exempt at least some construction sites from closing. It says that the central infrastructure, which is what we're talking about getting exemptions, includes construction, and then it says in parentheses, including but not limited to construction required in response to this public health emergency, hospital construction, construction of long-term care and assisted living facilities, public works construction, school construction, kind of goes on and on. So there are several portions that are specifically excluded. But I don't know if that includes, for example, construction of an office building that's going to be having a bank as its anchor tenant. For now, as of today, they were still working away.
Yeah, that's my big question. Are construction workers considered essential workers? It seems like in some contexts they are. But as you mentioned, of course, this is a bank that's an office building. Some of the other projects that I thought of right off the bat were the former Grand Avenue Mall, now known as the Avenue.
Right. The Avenue. And as a matter of fact, I've been trying to reach the developers. They've not gotten back to me as of today to ask that very question, if they were affected by this, because what you have at the Avenue that's being built, well, you have offices that have already been built. Some of them have been built anyway and are now occupied, although those workers have probably all been told now to go work at home. But the big portion of it that hasn't been completed that was to be done by late spring is the Third Street Market Hall, which is the large food hall that is to be the big showcase for the Avenue. I simply don't know if that's affected by this yet or not. Now, the reading of this order would suggest that that is not considered essential, but I have yet to hear back from the developers on that.
During this kind of lockdown, as all of us are staying in our homes, we're also perhaps predictably facing an economic downturn, which has a lot of people worried, especially, you know, we have all of these projects that were seemingly specially timed to things like the DNC. We of course, faced a financial crisis in 2008, just a little over a decade ago. What happened to projects then that were under construction?
Some just came to a screeching halt. One very good example that I can think of, Park Lafayette. It's a large multifamily housing complex over on the east side of Milwaukee at Prospect and Lafayette Avenues. That halted construction for a while because essentially the lender had to call in the loan. It went into default under the original developer. And it was originally built as condominiums. Because of the housing market collapse, it was taken over by the lender. Ultimately, the lender hired a different developer to come in and complete that project, and it opened as apartments. So those types of things can happen. We saw them happen, as you just made reference to, during the 2008 financial meltdown after the collapse of the housing market.
So we have this kind of concern. Of course, in Bayview, they are in the middle of building a pretty large complex. But again, as we've said, there's so many different buildings around the Milwaukee area that are currently under construction. Can you estimate how many more apartments are being added to the area right now?
It totals up in the several hundreds, if not low thousands. And I might add, under the governor's order, it certainly looks like housing construction is not verboten. And what you have in Bayview that you just made reference to is the project known as Kinetic, which is on Kinnickinnick Avenue, just as you enter Bayview from the north side of the neighborhood near Beecher. And I know Kinetic continues to be under construction. That's new land. And new land is also finishing up another apartment building called Quartet in Walker's Point. I spoke with Tim Gokman from New Land yesterday about that, and I believe they're looking at finishing both of those in May. So those are continuing, for whatever that's worth.
So right now it seems as though at least housing is going on. We just got this order, so I know it's a little difficult to say, but do we know kind of what projects might be excluded from being considered essential?
Well, the one you made reference to earlier, the Avenue, I mean, it's a food hall, essentially. That's what they're working on completing. I'm looking at the list, and I'm not sure that necessarily qualifies as essential infrastructure. So that's one. We already know that the convention center is being delayed, if nothing else, because of the fluctuations in the bond market as a result of all the financial turmoil. We reported that last Friday. So that's certainly going to be delayed, at least for the period that it takes to get through the financial turmoil, and they can better understand pricing for the bonds that need to be sold to raise the up to $425 million to build the thing. The other problem with the convention center is those bonds, that money that's being borrowed by selling bonds, the Wisconsin Center District, which operates the convention center, they'll pay down those bonds primarily with the taxes that they levy, and those taxes are on, guess what, industries, hotels, restaurants, and car rentals, all of which have been devastated by the pandemic. So they need to make sure that those industries are healthy before they can, you know, go out and sell bonds with the certainty of having the revenue to pay off that bond debt.
So I know this is a complicated question, and I think a question that we're all asking of ourselves right now, but do we know what the forecast looks like for commercial real estate in Milwaukee?
Well, you know, this way there's no real way of knowing. I mean, some of course is going to depend on how long this continues to go on, how long we have to continue to, the public health authorities advise us to continue to take these steps to try and contain the pandemic as best we can. Obviously, the longer it goes on, the less business activity you have in general, the more that hurts demand for the types of buildings, apartments, hotels, offices, retail centers that are being built. That's number one. Number two, once this ends, and it will end, once this ends and we go back to being able to circulate and commerce and business activity returns, how long does it take before you have enough people who are back working, who are no longer unemployed, who are then again spending money to again generate the demand for the types of things that are being built? I don't think anybody knows the answers to those questions.
Yeah.
So, sorry, that's not very helpful if you're trying to predict stuff, but unfortunately, sometimes things are completely out of our control, and this is one of those times.
Yeah. Well, Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You bet. You bet, Joy. Thank you. Thank you so much. And everybody, try and stay safe as you can. And please, for God's sakes, rely on reliable news sources, whether it's the Journal Sentinel, whether it's WWM. Please rely on reliable news sources and not nonsense and BS.
Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular contributor to Lake Effect. He spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find all of their previous conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up next, how one organization is working to keep Milwaukee's homeless population healthy during a pandemic. Lake Effect returns in a moment. I'm Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's hard to be safer at home if you don't even have a home. Homeless shelters and other social service groups around the world have struggled to keep their communities housed, clothed, and fed during the coronavirus pandemic. Not only does the virus threaten the health of homeless people themselves, transients can also spread the virus to the broader public. The Guesthouse of Milwaukee is one of the biggest organizations in the area working with homeless and disadvantaged people during this time. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with the Guesthouse's development director, Amy Rowell.
Working with vulnerable communities, I imagine, is pretty difficult at any time. But what are some of the challenges right now with all of the orders about self-isolation and staying at home? What are some of the differences and what are the challenges of working with vulnerable communities, homeless communities right now?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. All the time, we have different variables that we have to consider when we're working with individuals experiencing homelessness. And so with COVID-19, you know, there's certainly some unique challenges. So on site, we shelter 86 individuals across a couple of different programs that are seeking on-site services. And for those, you know, we're doing our best to make sure that all their resources and needs are being met in shelter so that they don't have to go out into the community. And certainly for those that do have to go out into the community, we're reminding them of washing hands, maintaining social distance, and just being safe while they're out at their appointments.
And these are people who already had spots at the guest house? These are people who were able to get in before the shelter-in-place orders came down?
So you're absolutely correct. The individuals that we're serving right now are those that were placed in shelter prior to the Safer at Home restrictions. Fortunately, we have an on-site behavioral health and addiction counseling clinic. We have case management on-site, so we're able to really provide many of the resources that folks would normally otherwise need.
And what are some of the needs that people have outside of the guest house? I mean, you say you have some staff. I mean, what are some of the reasons some people might have to leave? You know, I'm at home right now. The only reason I'm going out maybe is for a grocery run. So what are some of the reasons that homeless communities, homeless people might need to leave the shelter that might be different than the average, you know, sheltering in place kind of person?
So with many of the people that we serve, they have higher barriers to independence, many of which are influenced by their mental health status, by their physical disabilities, their medical concerns. Some of those we may not be able to resource on site, and we definitely want people to maintain their overall health. This is not a time to stop seeing their physicians, to stop getting their medications refilled. This is a time that people need to be extra vigilant in maintaining their personal health and well-being. So for those services that are required that we can't resource on-site, individuals are still maintaining those appointments.
How many people are you able to serve at any given time, whether it be just at a time that's not in crisis, and how might you be able to, in acknowledging that the crisis might get worse, be able to absorb that increase in people who might need your services?
That's an interesting question, and I'm really happy to answer it, because I think a lot of people only know us still for the shelter services that we provide. What a lot of people, I think, don't realize is that on any given day, we're resourcing approximately 1,000 individuals in the community.
Wow.
Yeah, these are folks that are based in the community that we're supporting through case management and care coordination. Maybe they are individuals that stayed in shelter, either with us or with another organization. For the most part, these are individuals that without those supportive services, they would have a housing crisis and would be likely to require shelter services. But with a little bit of support in the community, they're able to maintain their dignity and independence.
What are some examples of that?
Yeah, so these are individuals that have some of those barriers that the shelter folks do: mental health, addiction, cognitive or physical disabilities. You know, lots of people that we serve have long-term traumas, intergenerational poverty, again, the mental health, addiction aspects. And so these are individuals that, again, just with a little bit of support, they're able to maintain their independence. But as you can imagine, lots of organizations are sort of implementing work from home and all of the good social distancing practices. Lots of organizations are shutting down some of their on-site supportive services that individuals that we serve in the community, we're possibly one of many social service organizations that they're in touch with. So we're working extra hard to make sure that we are maintaining contact, even if only by phone, in order to ensure that individuals have adequate groceries, their prescriptions are being refilled, that they're navigating some of those relationships with their landlords, if they may be falling behind on rent. So in many ways, our community case managers and care coordinators are feeling a little bit of the pinch, more than maybe on-site at our shelter, because so many people are very aware of the services that we provide in shelter. We're working really hard to make sure that meals continue to come in, that critical needed items are still continuing to come in. And now we're really shifting a lot of our focus to make sure that we're supporting our community and those that are housed so that they don't become unstably housed. This is not the time that we need to be adding individuals to a shelter system.
I see. Now, your organization has been around for almost 40 years. And, you know, I think of one of the last times there may have been a crisis similar to this. People are talking about the economic crisis that, in addition to the public health crisis that is occurring right now. And I think of the 2008 financial crisis that, you know, a lot of people lost their homes. It took a toll on, I think, a lot of people's mental health. Are there any preparations for a situation like that? Or how does an organization such as yours prepare for the kind of economic uncertainty that might require your services even more? And how did you handle that in 2008, 2009, and onward?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In many ways, Guesthouse is well known for being forward-thinking, being very strategic, very person-centered. And when I say person-centered, I'm not simply referring to the individuals that we're serving, but also those providing the services and our greater community. We're constantly thinking very strategically about all the decisions that we make and what the impact and ripple effect might be. So we started thinking several weeks ago about what today might look like. And because of that advanced preparation, we feel that we're in a decent position. We're feeling pretty good about where we're at the moment. But again, this is something that's changing every day. So we started working several weeks ago on how do we maintain a safe and healthy shelter? How can we transition an area into an isolation area for those that are presenting with symptoms? Working with our greater shelter and community of how do we resource all of our needs in a safe and effective way? So having access to the health hotlines where we can call in with clients that may be presenting symptoms, to have healthcare professionals advise us of appropriate next steps, when and how to place individuals in more of an isolation area, and what does that look like? And then thinking even further down the road of how do we come out of this on the other end? And this is very, very different than 2008, 2009, economic challenges. It's very different from situations like Hurricane Katrina and broad natural disasters that definitely had an impact on fundraising and nonprofit life. This is different. It's going to require a lot of collaboration, a lot of creativity. Fortunately, we're hearing from many of our funding partners and community partners really with the attitude of we are all in this together. Several of our funding partners have indicated they know that we are sort of frontline essential services and that their support is there, including organizations like United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County. They're reaching out every day to find out what are our most pressing needs. So it's brought the community together in an even greater capacity, and I'm confident that together we will get through this, but it's very different than 2008, 2009. The ripple effect is going to be something that we are going to be experiencing for quite some time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm talking with Amy Rowell. She's with the Guest House of Milwaukee. Now, we're talking a little bit about homeless care in this time. You were talking about making preparations. And I also imagine you're very dependent, like a lot of organizations, on volunteers. How can volunteers stay involved while also keeping themselves safe and the people that you work with in this time of pandemic?
At this point, we have restricted on-site volunteer service. So we have volunteers generally that come in every night of the week with items that they have purchased and prepared for dinner. They come on site and serve it. And at this time, we've paused any on-site volunteer engagement, as well as any special project volunteer-based activities. We are still at this time encouraging and inviting individuals who are interested in supporting us to make and prepare bag lunches and sandwiches off-site and then contact us to deliver those. Every day, we distribute approximately 250 to 300 sandwiches just to our immediate community. So individuals come up to the door, ring the bell, ask if we have any sandwiches or bag lunches, and then they're resourced through a community window right near the doorbell. At this time, we're seeing a pretty dramatic increase in some of those requests as we're learning that some of the other local meal sites and formal programs have suspended or pulled back on some of their services. So for those that are able to safely do so, providing bag lunches and sandwiches so that we can continue to resource those to our immediate neighborhood is a great way for folks to get engaged, as well as responding to we have an Amazon wish list, and I know that some of those items might be held back that aren't considered essential, but for some of those essential items that we post to our Amazon wish list, which is accessible right off of our website at www.guesthouseofmilwaukee.org, those can be purchased and delivered straight to us so that we can immediately resource those to our programs in need.
Lastly, how are you keeping your employees safe and the community that might interact with some of the people that you serve? You said they wash their hands whenever they leave, but what are some extra precautions that you might not take in any other time in addition to the ones that we might be familiar with?
Yeah, so it's hard because we're people. We really like people and when they come and visit us. But at this time, when folks are dropping off donations, again, we're asking them to sort of wait at the loading zone, call the office to let them know that they've arrived. The office is going out with a cart, leaving the cart at the curb and then stepping back so that they can maintain social distance while the donor loads the items. And then the staff member will return the cart of items back into shelter for distribution. And then, of course, wiping down the cart and washing hands and all of those good practices that honestly, hopefully some of those will continue afterwards, in order to reduce the risk of this, just the general spread of germs. But at this point, we do have to restrict folks that are coming into the building in order to keep it as healthy and safe as possible.
And I understand that you're home as well, just like we all are.
I am working from home right now, at least for probably the next 2 weeks. But my desk phone forwards to my cell phone. I feel like I'm on email and attentive more than I normally am. My husband had to remind me last night after dinner that, you know, I could be done working for the day. It was just so natural and easy to want to come back up into my home office to continue working, because just the demand for information and resourcing different needs, it's really high right now.
Well, thank you for sharing your time with us today and keeping Milwaukeeans safe and sheltered and their needs met. Amy Rowell works for the Guest House of Milwaukee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amy Rowell is the development director for the Guest House of Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida, and you can find out more information at wuwm.com. This weekend will mark 1 year since a homeless man was found beaten to death on the steps of a Milwaukee church. 53-year-old Johnny Smith was found dead in a sleeping bag outside Redeemer Lutheran Church last year on March 29th. The congregation was deeply impacted by the tragedy, and this weekend they had planned to honor Smith with a special service. But, like many other churches, Redeemer Lutheran has been forced to close to the public. However, the service will still go on, virtually. Lake Effect contributor Barbara Miner brings us a story of how the church plans to honor Smith and how they've adjusted to a time of social distancing.
Blessed Lord Jesus, who takes away the sins of the world.
Lisa Bates Froiland is pastor of Milwaukee's Redeemer Lutheran Church at 19th and Wisconsin Avenue. She remembers clearly the day her life as a minister changed forever, March 29th, 2019.
It was a Friday morning, was looking forward to a day of unscheduled time, when I looked down at my phone and I saw I had several messages. And when I opened them up, I was very surprised to hear the voice of my communications specialist saying, "There's been a murder, a man is dead." And it made my heart just sink. And coming to grips with the fact that someone had lost their lives while sleeping under the protection of the alcove by our east steps was very difficult.
The man killed, Johnny Smith, was homeless. Another homeless man has pled not guilty to the murder by reason of mental disease or defect. Redeemer Lutheran, meanwhile, faced an immediate question: how to respond.
This congregation is comprised of people who understand that grace as a response is effective. And so there wasn't anyone saying, "We need cameras, we need guns." Instead, it was like, how could we have prevented this from happening? What is still needed in this part of our neighborhood that isn't here right now?
To honor Johnny, a requiem is planned for the anniversary of his death. But there's also a larger focus.
In this case, what happened on the steps is one person with an undiagnosed and untreated mental illness being told by voices to take the life of a man who was sleeping on the steps because his behaviors as a result of his undiagnosed and untreated mental illness meant that he was not welcome to stay in shelter. For those reasons, then, we want the Requiem to help be an opportunity to raise funds for the establishment of a mental health clinic here at Redeemer.
For the Requiem, Pastor Lisa turned to the church's musical director, 22-year-old Aaron Musser, whose music is playing in the background. Aaron has been composing a choral work, Requiem for a Homeless Man.
The Requiem essentially is an ancient Latin rite that commemorates the soul of one who has died. And it's meant to acknowledge this person who is gone and to say, "Lord, please have mercy on them, give them rest." And that's what the word Requiem means. It is Latin for rest.
Throughout early March, rehearsals continued, but then reality intervened. Like many other churches responding to the COVID-19 crisis, Redeemer Lutheran has canceled its public services. The new date for the Requiem is May 3rd. But the congregation still plans to honor Johnny on the anniversary of his death with an online virtual performance.
The new plan for March 29th is a virtual choir release in order to honor the date and to still come together as a sense of community, even if it's from a distance. The Requiem will be released on RedeemerMilwaukee.org, and there will be a donate button so that people can contribute to the mental health assessment clinic.
Heartbroken Jesus, who takes away the sins of the world.
Barbara Miner is a writer, photographer, and producer. You can find more of her work at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Julian Haida and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Jack Herbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach, Marty Michelson, Susan Bentz, Taryn Powell, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News Team this week. Lauren Sigvison is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.